This episode of This Creative Life has some adult language, so if you are listening with small kids around, just be aware. Thanks.
Hi, this is Sarah Czar, and you're listening to This Creative Life. Hooray! My guest today is the one and only Gail Forman. You may know her from such books as If I Stay, Just 1 Year, and most recently, I Was Here. She's a New York Times bestseller and has racked up a whole lot of other accolades that you can find out more about by some judicious Googling. Judicious? That's not the right word. By some aggressive Googling or just some easy Googling?
Some curious Googling, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, if you're curious. Yeah. She, like me, is a member of the Born in 1970 Club. 44 and loving it!
Woohoo!
And as a world traveler, we've been trying to get our schedules to match up for a while to do this, and I'm very happy that we have at long last succeeded. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm so excited for doing this as well.
This is fun. Before, you know, much like my last guest, Melinda Lowe, before you were a novelist, you were a freelance writer doing mostly magazine work and magazine journalism. And I'm curious... I don't think I ended up asking Melinda this, but I'm curious to know from you, what did you learn during that time about writing or habits or the business or anything that you found has been helpful to apply to writing novels?
The stock answer for that, which still holds true, is that I learned to write. Like, being a journalist for 12 years was my MFA program. It's how I learned to write a novel. Writing magazine work, you do a lot of, you get to be kind of more narratively creative than you do maybe doing straight news. So I developed an ear for dialogue and setting the scene. And I learned that I hate writing descriptive writing if it's visual descriptive, but that I enjoyed using kind of other sensory descriptive. So I think on that level, because I was a journalist and then I wrote my first book, which was a nonfiction book, but had 8 chapters each with a narrative within it, that taught me how to write a narrative. So that's one thing. But then a couple of months ago, there was a sort of quote from Ira Glass going around about how anybody who wants to do something creative, you're going to have a really long period of time producing kind of mediocre work. That's just how it goes before you kind of start to hit your stride. But that the trick was that you just need to produce large, large volumes of work. That's how you do it. You get the work done. And I realized, you know, particularly when I was on staff places and I was producing, you know, a 2,500-word article every month, that really was my boot camp, not just for learning to be a better journalist, but in terms of just getting that large amount of writing out so I could kind of get to the place where I wanted to be. Not that it's ever a destination you arrive at, but you start to kind of see it on the horizon.
Right, right. It's that closing the gap thing and also the Malcolm Gladwell thing of getting the 10,000 hours.
Exactly.
And accumulating that experience.
Yes.
One of the regular gigs that you had as a magazine writer was at 17 Magazine. Do you feel like that was instrumental in you being drawn to telling stories about the adolescent experience, or were you already kind of inclined that way and that's why you were working at 17?
It's the latter. I was already inclined that way. When I was in college, I took a few years off before going to college, so I was in college in like the early to mid-90s, and that was when Sassy magazine was ascendant.
I loved Sassy.
Yes, obsessed with Sassy.
Yeah.
And when I realized I wanted to be a journalist and a magazine journalist, I set my sights on Sassy. Unfortunately, by the time I graduated and was ready to sort of go to work, Sassy was
the new Sassy.
It was the new horrible Sassy. It had been taken over by the pod people, and it was in L.A. And then Sassy just completely demised. That was the end of Sassy. But 17, which had really been, like all the teen magazines had been shaken up by Sassy, had kind of taken up the mantle and was doing really great and interesting and kind of authentic stuff. And so I decided I was going to get a job there. And I hassled them and hassled them and hassled them until they gave me a job. And then once I was there, I hassled them even more because I was hired as associate editor. And I'm like, I don't think I want to do this editing thing. I think you guys need to make me a writer here, a staff writer. And they did. And then this other editor-in-chief came in, and she was really, really dedicated to doing stories about young people and social justice, which I'd already started to do at 17, but just not with the same regularity that I did when this other editor-in-chief, Patty Adcroft, came in. So basically, that was when I went to sort of Sierra Leone to talk about child soldiers, and I traveled all around the world, and every month I would do sort of a very serious reported piece for them with the occasional fun essay or like list article, like 75 Reasons Why Life Without a Boyfriend Rocks. I still did not realize, even after I left 17 and was a freelance journalist, still writing about young people, even if not for an audience of young people, and even that nonfiction book really focused a lot on young people. When I wrote my first YA novel, which was based on an article that I'd written at 17 about behavior modification boot camps, and the article, the book is called Sisters Insanity. It was like this big light bulb, and it was so obvious. Like, obviously, I had been drawn to this readership and to this age group and to this style of writing from the get-go, but it took me 15 years to kind of realize, like, oh, wait, this is what I'm actually meant to be doing.
That what you talked about of just kind of harassing them until they gave you a job and then basically telling them which job to give you once you were there, that confidence and that assertiveness, is that something that's just always been in your nature, or where did that come from? I think that's something that's really hard for a lot of writers, tend to be not super confident and assertive. It's part of what, you know, we're just those of us who write a lot of times when we were in high school and young adulthood, we were a lot more reserved or a little timid. And so the adventure was sort of in our heads instead of in real life. And so have you just always been kind of like a go for it type of person?
I haven't. I was really timid as a kid, sort of very clingy. And when I was 16, I was an exchange student in England, which was a bizarrely shocking thing for me to do, because I had gone away to summer camp for 2 weeks when I was like 12, and I'd been miserable. But my dad sort of strangely pushed that to happen. I sort of saw an article or advertisement in a magazine once being like, being an exchange student. And I thought, oh, that'd be great. I'm going to go live in England where all the bands I like live. And I sort of sent away for this brochure, and my dad really kind of latched onto it in an uncharacteristic way, because I think he said that he saw that I needed something like that. So that year, which was not an entirely easy year, it was partially wonderful and partially horrible, but that year kind of gave me a different kind of bravery and confidence. But I have to say, in terms of getting the job at 17, that came after a very low point where I was in New York and I was working at this other magazine, and I was so miserable because the magazine was dying a death and the editor-in-chief was crazy, and she had been like this very successful editor-in-chief, and she was less so now, and she was a tiny staff, and she would just go to town on me, like once she threw her bag at me, and I thought, I can't
it's
be in the situation.
Like the Devil Wears Prada.
Yes, except the bag wasn't nearly as nice as one of those. And my dad had been visiting me, here with my dad again, and I was so unhappy. And he said to me, he's like, just quit your job. I'll loan you some money. Just quit your job. And I said, no, I'm gonna do this. And that kind of renewed my resolve, and I had been bothering 17, and I kept, and that was sort of, I just went after them again, and I'm just like, I know, because I've been working in a magazine about women in business. I said, I know it doesn't seem like the, you know, I'm the obvious choice, but I am right. And the job opened up shortly thereafter, and you know, I made my case.
I love that story, and that it's not easy. I mean, sometimes things that look easy from the outside are, sounds like it was challenging for you to like work up the will to get that done.
But that's been a recurrent theme in my life, where it seems like things are bottoming out and that I've just hit a low. And that you think that you're going to reach a certain point, and that's never going to happen. But like your work life, like your regular life, it requires like constant recalibration. And it seems like there's something about that, about being like, you know, there's nothing to lose here. I'm going to go for it. Mm-hmm. And that it's always been like the brush fire that has kind of cleared everything out so new things can start to bloom. So that's happened kind of repeatedly, where it's been off of this low that I've managed to be like, wait a second, it's a very clarifying moment. I don't like where this is going. And that's a horrible feeling. But the kind of opposite, really exhilarating feeling is I have the power within me to do something about it and to change tracks.
Yeah, it can be easy to convince yourself that you're completely helpless. I mean, it's this weird balance of needing to let go of an idea that you can control outcomes necessarily, and definitely that you know, letting go of an idea that you can control other people, but at the same time, recognizing your own choice-making power.
Yeah, and that's huge.
Yeah, and your own ability to say, I don't like this. I don't like where this is going. I don't like how this feels. I don't like my life. And that's up to me to figure out.
Yeah.
This seems like a good transition to kind of, I'm coming up on my 10 years in the children's publishing business anniversary. I got my first book contract in May 2005.
So you're a tween now as a children's
tween,
author.
Yes. Yeah. Your first book came out in 2005. And one thing I want to do on the podcast over the next year is really talk to a bunch of people who have been in their field for around that 10-year mark. And so I've been contemplating this milestone, and I'm really interested in what you've discovered or learned or been surprised by or disappointed by in those first 10 years publishing YA. What are your big ahas from that experience?
It's funny because I don't feel like I'm at my 10-year mark. I mean, my first book was published in 2005, but that was an adult, adult nonfiction, and it felt so completely different, everything about it. And then my first young adult novel came out, I think, in 2007, but it was such a quiet publishing. It was really, you know, it kind of came out and nothing happened. So it really feels like I've only been in the business since 2009, because that's sort of when If I Stay came out, but that's also when I really started to become part of the young adult community. I mean, I remember when my first YA novel came out and I went to a reading of, it was like David Levithan and Carolyn Mackler, and I was just sitting there in the audience. It was like at the old Borders that no longer exists in Columbus Circle. And I felt like, you know, the kid outside the store. I'm like, I want in. So it's only been since, I think, 2009 that I feel like I have been part of that world. And
a lot's happened.
A lot's happened.
You've had 10 years worth of a career for sure in that 6 years.
Absolutely. And where I am now, and it has only been just now, is that I think I'm finally getting over my fear that they're going to take away my seat at the table. So
describe that fear, because I think that's something when I'm talking to people who are just starting out and I express those kinds of feelings, they're very surprised that,
like, you're Sarah Czar.
Yeah, someone who's been doing this for a while would feel that, like, not really belonging, or like it's going to get taken away, or I'm going to be found out to be a fraud. You know, all those imposter syndrome feelings that I think everybody has. So what do you think kind of got you over the hump of feeling like this was going to be taken away from you any second?
I mean, I think it was partially everything that came from the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really sort of lifts you into a different... It helps. It really does. I mean, I'm not going to... But I think that there was also just... I also think it's my age. Like, like you, I'm in the 1970 Club, 44. And I like getting older for this because I see giving a fuck in my rearview mirror a little bit more. Like, I just don't care. I'm going to be myself, and if you don't like it, well, that's okay. I have some wonderful friends, and I'm going to do the work that feels urgent and authentic to me. And this realization that being able to fall down, like, I want a long career, and that means that not every book is going to connect. And I just had this, like, sense, and publishing doesn't these days do so much to discourage this sense that one false move and it's all over, yeah. Which is a terrible place to be creatively if that's what you think is going to happen.
Yeah, I would say that my experiences right now are very similar in that feeling of just, okay, you know, I've reached certain milestones and had these things, good things happen with my books, and I've had disappointing books and I've had successful books. And I think what I've realized is that the rewards of the tangible rewards of things like money and sales and attention, getting to go to things, being a name, feeling relevant, those rewards are fairly, I'm going to say they're a little flimsy. Like, they're not something strong enough to hang your identity on, you know? And I think when I started out, I had the perception that once I achieved those things, that'd be a really solid place to stand on, and I could, like, do anything from there if I felt like I had, quote-unquote, like, proof of mattering or something. And so I think as you get into your 40s, or you've just been in something for a while, just realizing those rewards, they're great in themselves, and they're something to be proud of, and they're nothing to, you know, scoff at or anything, or not want, but they're not a solid, like, foundation to stand on from which to do great work. And so once I came to my own understanding of what those rewards were and how limited they are and how fickle they are and elusive, that I have to ask myself, well, what do I find rewarding and how can I get that? That's a question that I've been asking myself a lot. And I'm curious for you, like, have the rewards of having a good career, how have they been different than you thought? Better, worse? What have they taught you? Because you've kind of reached a certain pinnacle that I think a lot of people in our field would be shooting for in terms of the tangible commercial types of things, like New York Times bestseller, getting a successful movie made, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so your view from there, what can you tell us about how that is awesome or kind of like, it's fine, but it's not who I am?
It's exactly what you have come to in your own thinking, where, and I think this is true not just for writing or creative endeavors, but anything. If your validation comes from an external source, you are fucked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are in trouble because that is so fickle. And you are completely dependent on things that are so outside your control. And that is such a terrifying feeling. You are, you know, dependent on how your publisher is going to publish your book and what the market is like at that point and what the reviews say. So it's just all of this external validation, which when it goes in your direction feels really good.
Mm-hmm.
let's not lie about that.
Yeah.
But you also, it can only feel so good. There's that little voice telling you, will not always be so.
Right.
So the important thing then is to kind of come back to the things that give you a sense of internal validation. And that can be whatever. It can be family. It can be friends. But if we're going to talk about publishing, it's the work. It's the satisfaction you get from producing the work. And my fear of the, you know, my seat at the table being taken away. Of course, it's financial. I've got kids to put through college, all of that stuff. But really, it's because I love doing this work so much that once I realized this is what I wanted to do, I didn't want to do anything else. And I was scared that, you know, if I wrote, you know, a couple more books that nobody read, because nobody's read my first two, that they were going to not let me do that anymore. And the work itself is so satisfying. And you could say, oh, if it's so satisfying, then you could just do it as a hobby. But, you know, I think there's something to it about just not just writing the book, but sharing it and also being able to do it every day because it's your job that I love. So whenever all that other crazy stuff is kind of driving me crazy, I try and kind of bring it back to the one thing that I can control, which is the work, and that's the thing that brings me so much satisfaction. And I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's it's so true. Like, you can, all this stuff can happen around you, and it's just swirling around you, whether it's good or bad or it's like tumbleweeds. It doesn't have anything to do with, like, if you want to go to bed at night and sleep peacefully, you have to have done your work. You know, you have to have showed up and done your work, and that's sort of the bottom line for that. It seems like, at least for the time I've been doing this, and I'm sure you've had the same experience and observation, it's just like the young adult publishing world has changed so much in the last 10 years. And it's got like a boomtown kind of feeling to it.
It's like Gold Rush. That's
exactly.
What I, yeah.
That's what I, that's the exact thing that I was, the exact phrase I was thinking about. You know, publishers struck gold with a couple big books, and then it really opened up, and everyone's like, there's gold in them hills.
Yeah.
And so it's gotten pretty crowded, and also just feels like higher stakes, although it's kind of funny to even, like, I just laughed as that term, higher stakes, came to mind because
we're not surgeons. We're not saving anybody's lives.
There's a lot of money. There's competitive bidding on books and bigger advances. And then as our agent recently pointed out on Twitter, although I know you're not on Twitter right now, but he was talking about kind of a bigger gap too between the haves and have-nots, just the way that the greater world economy has gone, so goes publishing, where there's, you know, a few people getting a bunch of money, and then there's a lot of people hardly getting any. Anyway, all this is just to say the field has gotten a lot more crowded since we started out. When I was working at a bookstore in the 90s, the young adult shelf was like one little corner of the store, maybe a foot wide shelf, floor to ceiling. Do you see the fact that it's more crowded now, or I should say that there's more options, make it sound more positive. Just basically, do you see that as a pro generally for YA writers, or a con, or do you see a shakeout coming? It just feels like there's so many books, and young adult can't keep publishing so many books.
I don't know what it all means. No, I know what it all. I think about this a lot because, you know, every time I read a book that I think is so magic, and I'm just like, why isn't this? Is this going to break through? This has to break through. So I'm going to name drop the book that I just read, which was Susan Juby's The Truth Commission, which I adored. It's like everything that's wonderful about young adult literature. It's got this great voice and grapples with some really deep issues and does it in this really imaginative way, and made my heart feel bigger and also felt like a thriller in a weird way. And I thought, you know, this is what's great about young adult. And why is everybody should be like waving this book around and talking about it? And the crowded marketplace means it just feels like spaghetti being thrown up against the wall. And I have broader concerns, not just about why, but just about publishing in general, you know, looking down the future and seeing, knowing that it's going to change and not knowing how it's going to change. And, you know, in my idealized version, I think, well, it just means that everybody will, you know, pay more attention, and or there'll be this different way that people think about publishing, and it'll be more thoughtful. But I don't know. In terms of like it being a crowded marketplace, yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit more like the Hollywood model now, where it's opening weekend. You know, if you don't earn your stripes, like then you'd lose your co-op. And I don't know if how much you talk about co-op in the shows, but in publishing, it's hugely important. The co-op
I don't think we've ever actually explicitly talked about it, but this is a great opportunity just to explain to people what it means.
Right. So when you see books on tables or end caps at Barnes and Noble or bookstores like that, like that's paid advertising.
Right. Publishers pay bookstores to put those books there.
And there's so many books out there. So to have something kind of front and center that puts your book in front of people, that kind of helps you out. And that's where the sort of the crowded marketplace of it is, just like who's getting that and how long you're getting it for. And if you get that, but your opening weekend isn't great, like, are you going to lose that? That whole concern comes from the sort of crowdedness. And then, of course, you talked about the haves and the have-nots. And you look at the bestseller list, and it's basically a movie list for kids. And so I was the beneficiary of that. And at the same time, I realized how hugely problematic it is, because it used to be like the bestseller list back when it was separated with hardcover and paperback. The hardcover bestseller list was like a place to sort of see like what was new and what was really breaking out. And and because the indies have, you know, a good amount of weight on those lists, you really got a sense of like what the independent booksellers were sort of hand selling, and it gave you a chance to. But that doesn't happen now, because it's just sort of taken up by books that have been made into a movie and had the benefit of all of that promotion, advertising, and breaking them out into the wider world. So I don't know what it all means for the future. It certainly concerns me, but I think this is what happens when, you know, it's. Children's book publishing has been such an economic force. So this is kind of one side of that economic force. Everybody's kind of stampeding toward it. And then on the flip side of that, you get some of those snarky articles being like, oh my God, I can't believe you're reading this.
Yeah,
which those things just crack me up, because I think every time youth culture becomes an economic force historically, you've seen this, like whether it's the Beatles and people freaking out or, you know, going on from there. But every time the adults, and we are adults, but we're also in kidlit, see this youth culture impacting and infringing upon the general culture, there's this sort of backlash, freak out.
It is, yeah, it's all just, it all comes with having a higher profile. It's funny because I think when I was starting out, the complaint was always like, no one even knows what YA means, and you say that, and they're like, what is it? And that was our complaint, like, we just wanted to, like, be in the center ring of the circus, and now we are, and now we have all these complaints about that.
Right, we can't win. I mean, and I think that the marginalization of why, which continues. We're always at the kids' table at Thanksgiving. But I think that's, A, one of the reasons we do have this pretty exceptional camaraderie. And I'm not going to pretend that, like, people aren't competitive and this and that. But I haven't ever lived in the adult literary world. But I do feel like we do have some amazing support, and people are genuinely really happy or pretty happy when things go well. So yeah. I think that that's part of it. And then I think the kind of wonderful experimentation that we continue to see mm-hmm. is also because we're still a little bit at that kid's table.
Yeah, that we can play.
Yeah.
So you've recently taken a step back from Twitter, and we've talked a little bit about that just privately, but how has that been going? What made you decide to do that, and how's it going?
I'll answer the second question first. Twitter is just, it's not good for me. And I might even sort of exaggerate this out and suggest it's probably not great for writers in general, because it seems to answer a lot of our needs, but it really doesn't. So,
God, that is, you know, that's a perfect description of Twitter.
Well, on one hand, it feels like company. You know, Sarah Dessen, who's somebody who's exceptional, who does Twitter really well, talks about it being her water cooler. And she seems to just do it actually quite well. She's got a zillion followers, and she has a really nice kind of banter with them. I've never managed to do it quite so well. So, you know, I'll be kind of lonely, because what we do is a very solitary job. And so Twitter feels like the water cooler, only it's not. You know, I find more satisfaction sometimes just emailing a friend if I can't have that one-on-one, but 140 characters just is not enough. And so there's that. And then there's the fact that it becomes like this addictive little thing. It's distracting. It can kind of keep you from doing the hard work of your work. And there's a little ego boost to it. But like with all of those things, you kind of go on, you post something, and you see who responds to you. And then it becomes like a habit, like you can't stop looking. And then it never feels as good. It's almost like taking a hit of a drug, and then it wears off, and then the next hit's just never quite as good. So not that I know anything about that.
I know, I'm like listening, and I'm just terrified about myself, but go ahead.
And then lately, I just think the kind of culture of rage that has taken over social media, which I think is a result of the disassociation from people. You know, you hear these stories. There was a sort of terrifying This American Life with Lindy West talking about her troll.
Yeah.
And this guy had done the most hideous things to her. And when she actually responded in a personal way, he was sort of contrite and horrified because he didn't realize she was a person. So there's a whole lot of that going on online. And I like to have kind of conversations about interesting and provocative things. And I used to do that on my blog, and it felt like we had that conversation in comments. But now just how angry people will get, and it made me feel both that gross like ego hit, and am I going to get it, but also a little bit always frightened looking over my shoulder with anything that I posted. So I just decided to stop completely, and it feels really, really good. Like, I feel like maybe I'm missing something. Like I'm, you know, had a couple of events where I thought, well, maybe I should have tweeted more about this. And I do have somebody who will go up sometimes on time, or I'll just post like this is happening. I thought, oh, well, you know, maybe I'm missing my audience and they're not knowing what's going on with me. But I think that the trade-off, if that is the case, is still worth it. I feel cleaner somehow.
Yeah, this is going to be my big thing that I want to figure out this year. I had a good start a couple months ago, and then I'm kind of back to my old ways.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'll have some lapses, but because that's the nature of these things. But and I'm sure there's probably other people out there that do Twitter better than me. But the fact of it is that it's just I have things in my personality that I don't love. There's sides of me that I don't really like, and everybody has this. But Twitter seems to activate all of that. So if I can avoid that, then
I
will.
It's so true. Like, you can just feel so right and just be like, I am so right now. And then like 20 minutes later being like, no, not really. No, I need to like pretend that never happened.
Just as people react differently on online and social media, I do too. Like, something that in the real world makes me happy and Twitter makes me full of envy. So I just think, well, then don't do that. Don't engage in that way, because it just brings out sides of myself that are there anyhow, but are so amplified for some reason by social media that I think, you know, I just feel better if I don't push those ugly buttons on myself.
Yeah. Last question. How do you, we talked at the beginning about how sort of bottoming out, being at a low point has always been a great catalyst for you to make change. When you're succeeding and things are going well, how do you stay hungry and like push yourself to the next thing that you want to do? Where does your drive come from?
The drive is just there. And, you know, people talk about wanting to get rid of their doubts and how awful doubts are. And I have to say that, you know, the doubts that tell you that you're a fraud, you have no right to do this, which we all have, and that you should just hang it all up. Those doubts, yes, you want to quiet those. But I kind of think the day I stop doubting my ability and stop wondering, can I do this, is the day that I've become terrible at it. So to some degree, that doubt drives me. Like, this isn't good enough yet. Like, mm-hmm. keep going. It's not good enough yet. But I don't think it's accidental that right now, for the first time in my life, I'm working on two projects, neither of which are young adult. One is an adult novel and one is a middle grade. And I think that is, to some degree, this sort of need to pivot away for a bit and see what I can do now. Because, you know, when I wrote If I Stay, I had published the two books and neither one of them had been, you know, particularly successful in terms of people reading them. And at that point, I didn't have an agent and I didn't have an editor, because the editor I'd worked with had left publishing. And I wrote If I Stay anyhow, even though I didn't have any of that. And even though as I was writing it, I thought, I'm not sure this is viable. It seems really dark and it's this weird narrative. But it was the work that drove me to do it. And I keep going back to that, to this idea that, you know, when you kind of don't know the way, but it feels like something you have to do anyhow, that's the good sign. So I think that in terms of kind of keeping things going, and it's about always trying something new and risky.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm doing now.
Well, I'm excited to see what comes out of you taking those risks. And thanks so much for talking to me today for the podcast. It was great to have this conversation.
I know. I'm so glad we could do it. I could keep talking to you all afternoon.
I know. Thanks everyone so much for listening, liking, sharing, and leaving your comments. A rating in the iTunes store is always nice if that's your thing. You can listen through the iPhone podcast app or Stitcher or straight from my website, sarahzar.com, which is also where the show notes for this episode will be, and we'll get some links on there to the book that Gail mentioned that she loved so much, and the This American Life piece that we talked about, and some other stuff. I am at Sarah Zar on Twitter because I'm still tweeting. Gail does tweet information. You can find her on Twitter as well. It's just at Gail Forman.
And I'm about to reinstate my blog. So it's
great.
Not that I am no longer sharing. It's just that I want to be able to kind of like go long form on it. And then
awesome.
We can all talk in the comments.
Terrific. And that is just GailForman.com. You can find her that way. Thanks again. And I'll be back with another episode soon. And yeah, I'll have to finish that outro later when I'm editing, because I just lost my train of thought.
Because you woke up too early.